Hi, Emily.
Hi, Josh.
Before we get into today's Sharp Objects podcast, we have to talk about TrueCar.
Yeah, dude.
Can I talk to you about TrueCar? Can I tell you about our great friends over at TrueCar?
Beep, beep.
I would love to tell you about TrueCar. I'm going to take the beep, beep as an acceptance. That's the green light?
Yeah.
Green light. Here we go. Vroom, vroom. All right, TrueCar. You know, Emily, if you're looking to buy a car, which I know you're not because you would have discussed this with me, right?
Excuse me, I have my own money. I can make my own choices.
You're going to buy a solo car without...
You don't know me.
I mean, look, what kind of car are you
I'd probably get a pretty small one.
All right, well...
We live in the city.
I did not realize that you were in the market for a car.
So maybe I am. Explain it to me.
This is exciting. This is exciting. So let me tell you about TrueCar, because if you're looking to buy a car, you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP.
I'm not actually.
Well, you might even know what it stands for, but I guess not. But what does it actually mean? The same goes for invoice, list price, dealer price... It's enough to confuse anybody.
That's true.
All you're really looking for is a price that actually means something. Introducing True Price from TrueCar. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership, Emily.
Wow.
It's very exciting. Ah. TrueCar dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of home. You love home.
Oh, I love home.
And comfort. You're a big fan of comfort as well.
This is a really good chair I'm sitting in.
How do you know if your true price is a great price? Because TrueCar shows you what other people paid for the same car that you want. And your certified dealers know this. So they set their true price competitively so they can win your business.
I love that.
Smart tactics.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, which apparently sounds like you are.
A new car.
Visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Okay, should we talk sharp objects?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sharp Objects episode 6 is over, but we're just getting started here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. I am Josh Wigler, joined here, of course, by Emily Fox, here to tell all of you that while it may not be safe for you on Sharp Objects, it is safe for you to listen to this Sharp Objects podcast.
I should think so.
I would hope so. That would certainly be my hope. I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
You probably, like, end up not liking our takes on things.
That is almost certain to happen.
I also feel like, you know, at this point, though, you should probably be into it.
Into our takes or into the show?
Maybe both. I don't know. If you've gotten this far, you're probably like, I'd like to hear what they have to say.
Or it's a morbid curiosity.
Maybe.
I certainly understand that as well. Either way, thank you for being here.
Yes.
Thank you, Emily Fox, for continuing along. Here we are 6 episodes in to this limited series, Sharp Objects, and another big episode here. How are you? What did you think? What did you think of episode 6?
I feel like we're really closing in on a lot of things. I think we're kind of understanding the wider berth of characters and maybe how they all fit into this weird little puzzle in Windgap.
Some family bonding going on here in episode 6 as Camille and Emma are going to go out for a night on the town. Just have the best time ever.
Seems like a really healthy choice.
Very healthy choice, indeed. Meanwhile, Detective Chris Messina, he's going to be doing a lot of investigating into Camille. He's hooked, but now he wants to know more.
I know, that little side smile grin he's got.
Love that smirk. Big fan of that smirk. Alan is going to, like, puff up his chest in this episode and be like, hey, listen to me. I have opinions, too.
And everyone's like,
shut up, Alan. God. we're going to get some flashback, you know, as has been the case here on Sharp Objects so far. We're going to get some flashback info on what's been going on with Camille earlier in her life. She's going to be reuniting with a bunch of people from high school in this episode. Some of that will be good. Some of that will be not as great. All in all, eventful, even if we're not necessarily any closer to figuring out what's going on here in Windgap. Of course, Emily knows. Emily has read the book by Gillian Flynn, upon which this show is based. I have not. I am completely in the dark. It has made for fun podcasting so far. And we are getting this podcast to you a little earlier than usual. We are recording this the morning after episode 6, Cherry, has aired. Typically, we record these later in the week, and we're able to get to your feedback as a result. But Emily and I, we're going to be packing up. We're getting out of town here for a little while pretty soon. So we need to record early in the week, which means no feedback this time around, that we have greatly enjoyed and appreciated your feedback. And so for next time, if you want to get that in, postshowrecaps.com/feedback is the way to do that. And make sure you are subscribed to everything we're doing on Post Show Recaps. Postshowrecaps.com/iTunes, Emily, is the way to do that. Emily Fox, as is our custom at this point in time in the podcast, I turn the conversation over to you. I flip the tip to you.
So, episode 6, Cherry. What did you feel, you know, watching this? Just your overall reactions. Did you want a piece of pie at the end?
No. No. I didn't like it because there's like little ghost girls existing in this episode. Which
haven't they existed in every episode?
Yeah, though? But they were just like, it was a little creepier this time around than usual. And this show is very unsettling and unnerving. And my delicate sensibilities are always on edge. This episode was really no exception.
Okay. Well, let's get started.
Yeah,
here.
Let's do it.
We're
let's
just
get started.
Getting started.
Yes, dig in.
All right. So first off, we have Marion sort of flashback. You know,
it's kind of a bookending of this episode.
Yes.
Is that Marion, who is Camille's deceased sister? We see some flashbacks involving her at the start of the episode, and I was confused, and you had to illuminate me on what was going on
right.
with that final scene of the episode where this little girl whispers to her, "You're not safe here." That's like a ghost of Marion?
Yeah, so that's
in the
book. Is
that a literal ghost?
That's in the book.
Or is it something she's seeing? She's just
Well, you know, those lines are blurred throughout this entire story, so it's safe to say that she could be, you know, sort of hallucinating or having one of her moments where she's kind of trapped in the past.
I'd be very shocked if it turned out that sharp objects had some sort of supernatural bent where there's actually ghosts involved.
Yeah, what if Marion's killing these little girls?
Oh, stop it. Don't mess with me.
I probably wouldn't say that if that was actually what was happening.
Okay, good.
Just to be fair.
This isn't a supernatural story, though, right? Like, that's not something that we're in for any
no,
kind of sucker punch.
I think it's more psychological.
Okay,
than
good.
Else.
Good. Very good. I think it's just important that we know what kind of show we're watching. Very, very, very important to just be on the same page that this isn't the type of show where a flying saucer is going to appear in the penultimate episode.
No, we're like more than halfway through, so I think we have a pretty good handle
good.
On things.
I hope so.
So, anyway, Camille is sort of in the same space that she typically is when these episodes start up, where she's kind of like dealing with flashbacks from her past and it's sort of melding together with the present. And then suddenly she's waking up next to Chris Messina.
Yes.
And she's sort of looking at his like beautiful bare back. Although, did you notice he had a tattoo?
I did notice he had a tattoo.
Yeah.
A cross on his back,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Good Christian boy.
Yes.
Not to be that surprising considering their location.
Christian boy. Chris Messina.
I'm sure that's why they did this.
No. I wonder if it's his actual tattoo.
I don't know.
What I did notice was the lighting or lack thereof in some of these shots of Chris Messina.
I know.
It's
like,
just a real dark pit in one specific region of the room.
I know. I was psyched for full frontal from him, and then I was like, you're right. Okay, fine, HBO.
HBO covering up. So Chris Messina, he's in bed, and Camille, she's going to wake up. She's going to drink some sink water, and he's just gonna like slowly rise to the world. And he's kind of like, he's like I said, he's in, he's hooked. He's like, what are we doing later? What are we gonna do tonight?
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, I'm seeing some people that you are not gonna want to hang out with.
Yeah. So what I really like about this is it sort of shows the morning routines again of everybody waking up.
Yes.
So we see Vickery get up, exact same routine we saw 2 episodes ago. Is that
right? I think
right?
so, yep.
And then Alan wakes up in his little couch.
I know. Alan's sleeping on the couch. This is where you would think that if Adora is the queen of the town that they could do a little better for Alan. He has to sleep on the pullout.
It's all about keeping up appearances. So as long as he's not obviously doing that with other people knowing, then it's safe assumption that he's sleeping in that beautiful white
got
room.
Got it. So it's better if nobody knows. So he's just relegated to the couch.
Yeah, I don't think
to
you
preserve the secret.
There's like a level of this where I feel like it's very much like old school, like you don't talk about things, like it's
sure,
like an old
yeah.
Christian sort of like sentiment where it's like, oh, we don't talk about our problems, we just like drink them away.
Got
it's like
it.
A very sort of like, I don't know, Christian
we
thing.
Put our problems on the pullout couch.
We fold them up.
And we fold them
and
up.
Shove them into the couch.
Indeed. Okay. So,
and
yeah,
but sometimes we ask to come to bed, but then we're like quietly putting our headphones
quietly
on
shut
and going
down.
Back to the couch.
Although something weird happened that night. And again, I'm just looking at Alan.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're a creepo and I don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows what's going on with Alan. But you're right. There is this sort of wake up ritual that we're seeing, not just with Vickery, but we're seeing it with Alan. You see it with Adora. I think you see Jackie a little bit in the process here as well.
Yeah.
So we're watching everyone wake up. this is a, it's definitely a recurring motif throughout this series so far.
One thing I'll mention, which is sort of anecdotal, and I don't know how much weight it really has, but it's interesting to kind of look at it from this perspective, especially since we are dealing with heat waves on a regular basis this summer. You'll notice that they have fans in all of their windows. They do not have AC in Adora's house.
Okay, well, it's an old house.
Right, and that's
part of... Hard to get central air.
No, but that's part of the understanding in the book. The way that it's written is like, this is a beautiful old house. We didn't want to change the integrity of the house. It's very important to keep it the way that it is. Therefore, everyone sleeps in it the way that they would have in like the 1800s. So you have fans, but like no central air, no AC whatsoever. So everyone's sort of like... a little sweaty.
it's a little hot and wind gap. Yeah. I certainly think that's appropriate for for the themes of the story, that they're turning up the heat and everybody's sweating a little bit the closer and closer we get to the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. So Camille kind of like rolls in after spending the night with Messina and is being rather coy, and you immediately see Adora like pick up on that, right? And she's like, all right.
Where you been?
Yeah, yeah, right?
Yeah, she knows. She knows that Camille has been out and about.
Mm-hmm. And so Camille is like, you know, she like pulls her car up or something. And don't they get like mad at her that her car is in the way?
They're mad at Camille the entire episode.
For literally everything, yeah.
Like, the entire series, yeah, really.
Truly, yeah. So, and then Camille decides to have some cherry pie, which is clearly left over from Wat Calhoun Day.
Yeah.
They just have like pie kicking around in the
kitchen. I gotta imagine they've got Calhoun leftovers for Calhoun Days.
Well played.
Yeah. Lots of pulled pork sandwiches on the menu, yeah, for the next few weeks.
Yeah. And then, we sort of see this quick flashback with Camille where she's eating this cherry pie and then suddenly she's a cheerleader again. And this is also foreshadowing for later in the episode when she hangs out with the girls who used to be cheerleaders with her. But there's the cherry pie connotation, which I think a lot of us already know about, like your virginity and purity. And that kind of comes into play and makes you unsettled, as most of her flashbacks having to do with like her sexuality as a teenager often do. So she kind of like snaps out of it and then quickly goes over to the maid and like kind of embraces her, which I think is lovely and sort of very telling of like, you know, what her life has always been like in this house.
Yeah, that she and Gayla have been secret best friends this whole time.
Yeah, and Gayla gets her. Yeah. So... you know, it's sad to kind of, you know, have that glimpse, but I think it's also really well done and would probably be most people's reactions if they were like eating something that was memorable and sort of reminded them of this, especially someone who's as traumatized as Camille is.
Camille has had a hard life. I think it is safe to say.
I think we've said that every single episode also.
Yes,
we're like,
every
man, this really sucks.
Episode just really reinforces how tough she has had. It has been a really hard time for her.
Yeah, and Emma sort of makes a joke about it. Camille is not cool with that.
She's making Emma, like, now that she knows that Camille has cut herself and now that she's like seen what Camille's body looks like and everything like that, she is this whole episode, like, you get the sense that like Emma puts on this front, but when the chips are down, like, she's like, she really wants to be closer to Camille. She wants to have that sister. She wants to know what it was like, because understanding Camille may help her understand her own existence.
Oh, for sure. I think, you know, anyone's looking for comparison when they have a sibling they don't know very well, right?
So I think it's like partly like her being incisive once again and like really trying to come after Camille, but also there's something authentic to it as well when she says like, look at this cut that I've got on my arm. If I keep needling at it, I can turn it into a C for Camille. Like, I think on one level she knows that that's going to get under Camille's skin, but on but on another level, I think like there's a possibility that like she feels like, wouldn't that be cool if I did the same thing that you're doing? And Camille's like, not cool.
Yeah.
Do not do what I do.
Yeah, and like later on, she even asks her too, like in a moment of like quiet where she's like, do you cut yourself? And she's like, nah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so while we like kind of drive away from Adora's house for a minute, Messina is doing his own drive through. He goes past where Natalie Keene's body was found, and there's been, you know, flowers and other sort of mementos and stuff put up in the place of where she was found. And he sees someone kind of like cleaning the space. So he gets in a little bit closer and realizes it's Jackie.
Nurse Jackie, indeed. Jackie is there and she's maintaining Natalie's memorial site. Yeah. And I mean, again, suspicious of everybody. Not going to be very surprised, like, based on whoever it ends up being, because I think all of these people have the potential to be horrible killers.
Yeah.
But Jackie is one that I've said a few times that I think that she could be somebody who is really deeply involved in this in some capacity, because I think thematically that would be such a disappointment for Camille, and I think that that could land really effectively.
That's true.
And Jackie being at this space and sort of the interactions that she has with Detective Chris throughout the episode, but being here in this moment, and I think that she has a line when Messina is asking about Camille and what happened to Camille,
yeah,
and what was the episode with Camille that kind of is like she's hinted at to him before, like he has a sense of her, and I think Jackie says something, either it's in this scene or maybe it's a little later, where she says, "You're getting warmer, detective."
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah, you're getting pretty hot right now, being as close as you are to Jackie. So I wonder. I think Jackie is high on my list of persons of interest.
Do you think, I mean, I think this is an obvious yes, but it's a huge conflict of interest for Messina and Camille to be hooking up the way that they have been?
Huge obvious yes.
Yeah, but like, how yeah, do you feel about that? Like, what is that trigger for you? Or is it any sort of like tell or anything like that where you're like, you know, does he really like her? Or is this, could this potentially be him investigating like more into the case as a whole by learning more through her? Right?
Yeah, I think that there's...
I mean, he's obviously said that he wants to kind of get more information out of her about the town as is, but, you know, is there more to it than just that? Could he potentially be looking into her in other ways?
Yeah, I think that that's certainly possible. I think, you know, one of the feedback messages we got not terribly long ago was from somebody who wrote in named Richard, who talked about like sort of the comparisons between Sharp Objects and Apocalypse Now, which I don't think that you've seen before.
No, I haven't.
Martin Sheen, classic.
I love Martin Sheen.
Classic Vietnam movie. I think this movie would really trip you out. I don't know that you'd like it, to be perfectly honest with you, and I'm not trying to underestimate you. It's literally, I know your sensibilities. I think this one might be a little too messed up for you.
Well, fine.
But we could, hey, anytime you want to watch Apocalypse Now with me, I am down to watch
Looking
Apocalypse
Now. Looking forward to the podcast.
Yeah, so we can
watch.
I don't think we're doing an Apocalypse Now podcast.
I have no idea.
Spoiler alert. But there is that idea. Idea of Martin Sheen's character in that movie, who's like kind of like going, like as he's getting closer and closer to the heart of darkness, he himself is kind of finding himself washed up in you know, in that same darkness himself. Like the closer he is to kind of like getting to the heart of his mission, the darker and darker it's getting. And I think that you could see that sort of happening with Detective Messina as well, as he's like getting closer and closer to the heart of the problem here at Wind Gap, that he himself is willing to kind of do some dark stuff.
Yeah.
So I could see that, like, in his mind, like, if he gets closer with Camille, that could get him closer to the truth. And, like, maybe there are aspects of his humanity he can sacrifice in order to get closer to the truth. I think it's possible. But I also did just kind of get the sense that I think he kind of likes Camille Preaker.
Well, they're both the outsiders.
Right.
So I think that they have a lot in common for that. And they both, you know, have similar interests in the case. They both want to get it solved. She wants to write a really good piece, and he wants to be able to figure out who the killer is. So
I don't think that he is sleeping with her because he wants to know more. I think he's sleeping with her because he likes her, but I think that he probably sees the advantage of getting closer to her, because Camille is very dialed in to the center of the wheel here in Wind Gap,
yeah,
that her mother is really at the center of everything. And even though Camille and Adora are not close in terms of their relationship, they're blood. Mm. They're close by the fact that they're family together. So
it's true.
Yeah.
But so after he sort of has this interaction with Jackie, he decides to go and you just spilled so much water on yourself.
I just spilled a lot of water on myself.
Cool down. I'll go on to this next move.
I just
move.
Spilled water out of my camel back onto
it, like,
my
landed
crotch.
Right on your crotch.
It's so awkward.
It's
anyway,
okay.
It's not a visual medium here at the podcast, so we could have gone and just ignored it, but...
No, I think that's this is why what I'm here.
You're here to let the people know when the camel back spills on my crotch? Where were you the 99 other times this happened? Anyway. Moving right along.
So Messina drives on, and he decides to hit up the rehab facility, actually, in which Camille was originally at, where her roommate ended up killing herself.
Right.
You know, and even the same nurse is at the front desk when he walks in, and he asks for paperwork and says, you know, Camille, you know, Camille Preaker, and tries to get more info because he's just, you know, working off of a hunch that Adora sort of, started by saying, you know, she's a delicate girl, she's had a breakdown, blah, blah. What do you feel about this?
He wants to know more.
But is that kind of like a overreach, considering that they have sort of an intimate relationship?
No, not if he thinks. But
that's kind of messed up.
It is kind of messed up, of course. I mean, just like on a practical level, it's kind of screwed up. But I think as a cop, as somebody who's trying to investigate what's going on here, if he thinks that there's a possibility that Camille could be more involved in this.
True.
You know, she's an outsider herself. Who knows, like, her coming back, and if she's got this history of violence, he wants to know more. It's definitely screwed up, but you have to start with the premise that their entire relationship is screwed up.
Yeah.
Like, this is a screwed up thing to do, but, like, what they're doing, like, the fact that they're, like...
it seems really normal and platonic, doesn't it?
You know, the fact that...
it makes sense that you would have sex with somebody who has, like, a shirt on and, like, only, like, rolls their pants down to here.
I don't know. I mean, I
controls it all to that extent.
No, the two of them being like dual investigators on this case. It's just it's a recipe for disaster. They've made how many rom-coms and ill-fated dramas about this very topic, you know? So it's the workplace relationship. It can work, but not without some work. Very tricky.
Wise words.
So yeah, so he's investigating her at the rehab center.
All right, moving forward, Vickery is at the pig farm in Wind Gap, and a kid's bike is pulled out of the water.
Yes, a bicycle has been discovered inside the pond at the pig farm, and Bob is there. Bob Nash is there. He's able to ID the bike as his daughter's. He has a breakdown. That was upsetting.
Yeah. And Messina rushes over, kind of sees the whole thing go down as well. And suddenly, you know, this is a big lead. This is kind of what they were looking for, right? They needed something to kind of tie things together. And now that they've found this abandoned bike, it's clearly Anne's. Messina demands employment records for everyone who's worked at the farm.
Yeah, so his, you know, and I think the right hunch at this point is like whoever, you know, this bike being found here likely means that whoever killed Anne works here or has worked here. And if not, then somebody's planting evidence is the other option. I think that that's discussed in this episode as well. Like either someone is foolish enough who worked at the farm to dump the bike here, or somebody's trying to set this up.
Right, right. So there are still a lot of question marks around that. Next, we're brought over to the carriage house of Ashley Wheeler's family, and John Keene is there, and he is waiting to kind of speak. He and Ashley are waiting to see Camille.
She's coming back.
Yeah, she's coming back to kind of, you know, talk with them some more, especially since Ashley was pissed about not being in the article that Camille had written before.
And that becomes clear that that's really what's going on, right, to some degree.
It's a popularity thing.
Ashley wants to be in the paper. Yeah. Like, she, even when she finally gets to speak with Camille, like, she's really sucking up to her and being right. Like, oh, you could have been a model.
Yeah. Like, you're a legend around here.
And then, like, I love the moment when Camille, like, turns off the recorder while they're talking.
Yeah.
And she's like, why'd you turn it off? She's like, because you're just, like, sucking my kneecaps. Yeah. Like, you're just, you know, you're really just, like, coming, you know, kissing my booty and not giving me the goods.
Yeah, well, Ashley's also, like, creating, like, a hilariously doctored story of, like, the two little girls were such angels.
Right, exactly.
Blah, blah.
It's very colorful. Very, you know.
Right.
We don't need all
when
that.
In
we
reality,
just need the hard, cold facts.
Right, but when in reality, you know, we learned in previous episodes that, like, John's sister was kind of like ruthless sometimes. She would put she put that pencil through that girl's eye.
Right.
So like, don't sit here and, you know, tell me that
she was an angel.
Yeah, she was
like,
an angel.
We don't have to speak ill of the dead, but give me reality.
Right, exactly. But the really interesting sort of interaction that we see, even before we get to the point where Camille's speaking with Ashley and John again, is that Emma happens to be there. Just, you know, by the pool sunning herself with her two other friends.
Right.
Right? And she's
And is one of them Ashley's sister? Is that what's going on?
I think that's what the connection is.
I wonder. Okay.
I'd have to look into that. But yeah, they're all just like, they're shooting the shit at the pool. And Emma is clearly hitting on John.
Yeah, she is. She's really coming after John. I mean, I think that this is just, you know, kind of classic Emma of, you know, attention seeking behavior, all of that. But she's trying to put the moves on John. It's hard to know what John is thinking about all of that. Like, he doesn't seem like totally closed off to it, but also seems like a little bit weirded out. But Emma herself just seems so strange in this, A, this episode, but B, this scene, and that great shot of her, like, you know, submerging herself into the pool, it's just spectacular filmmaking.
Yeah, here. I think that's really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you can see Emma's eyes sort of narrow. Like, what is she trying to dig at? What's she trying to get at here? I think she can be really manipulative in a lot of these scenes. And maybe John's just trying to get through it safely without being scathed.
Well, yeah. And I think it's worth considering, you know, this is the type of speculative stuff that somebody who doesn't know how this is going to end, I feel like I probably need to articulate, is like, so if Emma knows something, mm-hmm. And I think that's something we talked about as a possibility last week.
Yeah, like you brought that up.
If Emma knows something a little bit more than we realize, like if she has a hunch, like a real hunch about what happened here, then this is a really loaded scene. Like either like she knows something that John has done,
right,
or knows something that John has not done, but she knows something more than John knows. So there's also like this kind of like unspoken power balance that's being tipped along here in this scene, if that's the case, of like Emma playing with the information that she has and maybe playing with John's head in that way.
Yeah, and like don't forget that this was the same location where the blood was found by Ashley, right?
Right.
So yeah. We don't really know where that blood came from. Could that just be a coincidental thing? Who knows? But maybe Emma has something to do with that or knows about it.
Yeah, what if Emma's like trying to set up John Keane or something like that? Okay, all right. Interesting. Very interesting. I think that the loaded look between Emma and John, that's something that I'm sure in retrospect we'll think a lot more of that. But even just now, it's a very loaded and
really
like weighty moment.
Yeah. So anyway,
the interview occurs. It's kind of it's a little fluffy.
Yeah. And just like Ashley even talks about like how she was a cheerleader and like, do you miss cheerleading? And like this whole thing with Camille, and Camille like sort of has a flashback, right?
Yeah.
Where like there's blood on her.
Right.
And that's something I didn't even pick up on at first. I was like, oh, what is this? Like, I don't really understand. But it had been left over from her cutting herself, right?
That's what it seems to be when she's hanging out with her friend from her cheerleading days, like mm-hmm. the one friend who actually kind of liked her.
Yeah.
They have that conversation in the car later in the episode. Where it seems like that's what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty interesting. anyway, but we have sort of a flashback with, we're going back to Messina now.
Yes, no flashback. Messina's just like calling Camille.
Yeah,
because,
and he's like, yo, let's hang out.
What's up? Don't you want some of my spaghetti marinara?
Yeah. And I like that I wrote, he's psyched about making her homemade sauce.
Yeah, he's got sauce. He's got sauce that he wants to serve her. It's literally what he wants to do. He wants to make sauce and he wants to eat it with her.
All right.
I don't know why that's so strange. It's a little strange because he doesn't have a kitchen. So I don't know where the sauce is getting cooked or anything like that. But he's trying to...
It's jarred, I bet.
That's fine. He's just trying to woo Camille.
Yeah. And then we go back to Adora's house where Alan and Adora are sitting on the porch. This is when she tells her to move her car, I think, where she's like, hey.
Right.
Okay.
Because Camille comes back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Parks her car in an awkward way.
I don't know if it's that awkward. They have a humongous driveway. It's fine.
She just, in an awkward way to Adora, at least, she gets out of the car. She's like marching back into the house. And she starts like asking Adora all these questions about the bike. Like, why wouldn't you tell me about the bike? You know I'm here for the story. And,
right.
And Adora is like just doing her Adora thing and being very dismissive and gets angry with Camille. And she's like, are you interviewing me right now? Like, are you trying to like...
I'm your mother.
I'm your mother. And this is when Adora is going to say to Alan, I think she's outstayed her welcome.
Yeah.
Please let her know that.
Yeah. And so poor Alan is like, okay, maybe this will score some points where I don't have to sleep on the couch.
Right.
And, you know, he's being very supportive of Adora because I don't think that there's any other way to be being her husband. You literally have to stand behind her in everything she does because she clearly rules the roost here. So he's like, you know, you've been more than tolerant. Like, I'll handle it. That's basically what happened there. But the boss, meanwhile, Camille's boss calls back to like sort of check in with her, right? And I think that this is like really like a lovely moment because he's like, hey, what's going on? And then his wife gets on the phone with her too. But it, yeah, it's really interesting that there's like a moment.
The only two good people in the world getting a moment to speak on the phone.
I know. And it's really nice.
It's very nice. And during this phone call, I think, is when Camille tells her boss that like maybe there's a little bit of a lead. There may have been a little bit of a break in the case. We found this bike.
Yeah. So that's obviously great for the story and for the article she's going to continue to turn in. And he's sort of very supportive with her, as he always is. But it's good to hear, you know, that at least something's happening here.
This is when we get into the porch conversation with Alan and Camille. Alan, bless your heart for trying to have this alpha conversation with Camille. Camille, you've been very mean to your mother and she doesn't want you to be here and neither do I.
That was a really good
Alan. It's like the most you've ever heard him speak. It's just like, Alan, you were better when you were just listening to music.
Yeah, well, that actually, so this is written expertly into the show as it is in the book, where she just talks about how she's had a very sort of conservative and like weird sort of relationship with Alan as her stepdad, where like they don't really talk or have much in common. They just like sort of exchange niceties, and sometimes he'll like try to discipline her, but it's very much always been this like cold, weird exchange that they've always had. So I think it is so telling in this moment where you really get to see that like they really don't talk otherwise. Like he just like says hi and it, you know, the pleasantries of like a normal conversation, but there's no real substance there unless he's trying to perform some sort of duty via Adora, right?
And I think what's curious about this to me is there have been flashes in the past of Alan at the rehab center, right? And like bringing flowers and stuff. And I think the connotation at the time is like, oh, Alan's actually like a sweeter guy than you were giving him credit for, potentially, the royal you. And now, kind of in light of this episode and the conversation he has with Camille, for one thing, it's an uncomfortable conversation, and Alan doesn't seem like especially excited to be having this conversation with Camille. The tone of the back and forth between them, it's definitely frosty. It's definitely frigid. It's not like the conversation of two people who have an easy chemistry with each other.
Correct.
And the conversation is only happening because Adora made Alan have the conversation. And it makes you wonder, did Alan, in that image of him bringing flowers at the rehab center, is that something that was out of the goodness of Alan's heart? Or is it Adora being like, go inside and bring her these flowers. I can't possibly go in.
Right.
Something like that.
Right, yeah.
And so for me, like, I had been, you know, one of the reasons why, like, I was like, okay, I think maybe Alan isn't going to be end up being, like, such a terrible guy is because he seems like maybe he has, like, this underrated, you know, sweet relationship with Camille. But that's now removed. That doesn't seem like it exists anymore.
Yeah, it's a lot more formal than what you might have been led to believe earlier.
Yeah, so I think much like Nurse Jackie, I'm keeping Uncle Alan, Dr. Alan here, the pianist. I think he's pretty high on my list of suspects right now.
And yeah,
it's just escalating with each passing development.
And I really like, you know, sort of how he dives into the same historical, you know, significance of Adora's upbringing and how Adora's mother didn't like her very much.
Right.
Used to wake Adora up in the middle of the night and pinch her just because she was a mean woman or something like that. And it's like, okay, but does that really excuse the behavior that's been shown towards Camille? Like, Camille has not been this person who's historically, like, run around and, like, set fires and stuff. You know, I think she's been the victim of a lot of really brutal things that have not been talked about and have been very often swept under the rug. You know, just because her grandmother was sort of conniving and mean-spirited doesn't mean that Adora needed to necessarily be that way towards Camille, right?
I'm just having a hard time getting over the fact that Adora's mother would just pinch her in the night. Like, who's going around pinching people in the night? What an odd thing to do to people. Just like, wake up, here's a little pinch. You know, just like, who's doing that? This pinching prankster.
Who wants to wake their little kid up?
You're a mean one, Grandma Pinch. I don't trust this person.
Yeah, well, I don't think we have to worry about the grandma.
She's out of the picture.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think she's going to show up.
I don't like this history of pinching that has been introduced this late into Sharp Objects. It makes me uncomfortable.
Maybe she had long nails and they were sharp.
I feel like it's giving you ideas, too. Are you going to start pinching me in the night, Emily? Ah, she's got the anchovy pick again.
No, the anchovy pick never got
put
away.
It never moved.
It's literally been on this desk the entire time. Oh, it's so fun to play with right now.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so anyway, I mean, that gives more, you know, sort of clarity on... I don't even know what to say. Like the craziness of this family.
Yeah, the history. Well, the history of violence and abuse that exists within this family for sure.
Right, right.
There's a cyclical quality to it.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And Camille, unfortunately, is not not immune to it.
Anyway, so Alan's like, "Please leave," and Camille's like, "Eh, you know, I'll leave when I'm good and ready." Like Camille's like, "You know, if you guys are gonna try and kick me out, at least send in the big gun. I'm not leaving because Alan's telling me to leave."
Cut to Alan like making one more like sweet tea and then pulling out his couch and being like,
"Oh, yeah, he loves his sweet tea." So Camille's gonna get picked up by one of her old cheerleading friends. This is something that we talked about last week, that this had been introduced, that like, oh, coming out for one of our girls' nights.
Yes.
So we knew that that was in the offing, and now it's upon us. She's picked up by her friend who is pregnant, who just has like bourbon on the rocks ready to roll in the SUV.
I mean, it's a to-go cup, right?
I guess. And just
but this, yikes!
This road drink. And I forget exactly what she says, but she says something like, she heavily suggests that she herself has been imbibing, and she's like deeply pregnant, and it's like, she's like, "Don't tell anybody."
And you're like, "Oh."
She gives
no.
the wink, like, "Oh, y'all are such hot messes here in Wind Cap."
Yeah.
It's a great character note, but it was just like a very, very.
Yeah, no, you looked at me and you're like, "What?"
I was like, "Oh my God." Yeah. This is scandalous.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff going down, and it's certainly not slowing down by the time you get to the house where all the women have already gathered. They're all watching like a chick flick together or something, and everyone is bawling.
Yeah.
Drunk and bawling. And hey, I've attended, you know, get-togethers with my old high school friends. Typically, like, you don't walk into a scenario where everyone is, like, good and liquored up like that already and, like, already serving massive, like, amounts of tears.
Don't act
trauma.
As if you haven't cried at movies.
Oh, I am the first one to cry at most movies, and especially ones where you shouldn't even shed a tear. I get very, like, emotional and, like, that's fine.
Like, if we're just channel surfing and we stumble upon Shawshank and if
that's a great
if
movie,
Brooks
though.
Is starting to talk about some stuff.
Shut up.
I Emily's
can, like,
just
going right
to start
now.
Crying, so don't all act so all high too. And mighty like you haven't cried at a movie before. That's all I'm saying.
I know. That's not an embarrassing movie to cry at, though.
It's a great movie.
It's a very good movie. Alas. So anyway, she shows up and everyone's just a hot mess.
She goes and she hangs out with her friend.
Right, right.
And they're just like kind of like, oh, it's like this every night.
Yeah.
Every time.
There's like one or two chicks that like really speak the truth at this. And they're like, yeah, like you're not missing much. This is kind of the normal standard. But then we cut to Messina. He's at the bar. Jackie is there again.
Right.
So it's sort of like the same exchange that they had earlier in the day. But is, like, Jackie making a move on him?
See, this is, again, like, I'm a little suspicious of Jackie. Of, like, I feel like she's, like, trying to dig in and try to get some information out of Messina because maybe he's getting too close. And if he gets too close, she could be in trouble. So it does seem like, in a way, like, she's got her, you know, she's keeping tabs on Detective Chris. And it does look like maybe she's like kind of being a little flirty with him, but that might just be who Jackie is. I don't know if like it's anything that she's expecting, but maybe she is expecting something and she kind of figures like, hey, roll the dice. Why not? Chris Messina's hot. Let's go for it. But he really wants to know more about Camille's stint in rehab. Is like very, very curious about what happened back then.
Yeah. But cut back to the party or not the party, but like the drinking get together of cheerleaders. Camille has a really, really kind of like tense moment with Mr. Lacey.
Yes, with Kirk. Kirk Lacey.
That's his first name, Kirk?
I believe that's correct. Kirk! but Lacey, yeah, he's there. He had already talked to her during Calhoun Day of being like, yeah, man, it's great to see you. I think about you sometimes. And he expounds upon why he thinks about her a lot in this scene.
Yeah.
Where,
which is like a crazy, like insane moment.
Yeah.
I think.
They both, you know, the show connects the dots that were already there that we talked about last week, where it suggested very heavily that he was one of the guys who was, you know, having his way with Camille at the end zone when she was a kid.
Yeah.
And it's confirmed here in this moment. He's like, he talks about like, think about it all the time. It's horrible. I'm so sorry.
And at least he shows remorse, because I think there are a lot of, you know, instances, especially in real life, where like you were a kid, you don't realize the nature of like what you've done. So like it's good that he at least, you know, is examining it and knowing that it was wrong. But what an uncomfortable,
it's kind of thing,
and
yeah,
horrible and like dreading moment for her, I'm sure, where
yeah,
she has to face him and he's like, listen, you know, I think about it.
Making it all about himself, like trying
right
to like offload the guilt and like, you know, get like some, you know, he wants to be absolved in this moment. That's not really going to happen for him. And like, oh, you thought about it?
Yeah.
You know, that
and she
kind of
like laughs at him because she's like, are you for real right now?
Well, she, yeah, she really, she gets to cut him quite a bit where she's like, as I remember, you could couldn't get it up, so what's the big deal? She
yeah
says something like that.
And then
he's talking about like this, like, don't be so dismissive, like this has really haunted me forever. And pardon my French, we're gonna drop an F-bomb here because the line is so good and it's worth
so
saying
good
in full. And she says, well, it looks like we both got fucked. And it's just like, holy snap, that is
yeah,
you know, really coming for his wig. So, you know,
as rightfully so.
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely. And I think it's nice to see these moments where Camille is able to like clap back at Wind Gap, you
yeah
know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, really like kind of like backhand her own history to a certain degree.
Yeah. So that's certainly like a very memorable moment, I think, in a lot of ways, where she at least is sort of made to deal with her past very directly and handles it, I think, swimmingly considering.
Yeah. All things considered.
Yeah. But then we kind of are, you know, Messina's at the bar or whatever. Jackie's making her move. And he's like really pushing, like, why was she in rehab? So this is something that in the book we don't really see him doing at all.
Right, because you said that the book is basically rooted in Camille.
Right.
You know, you're not really straying too far away from her.
Correct. And we only like see small glimpses of her being in rehab and then listen to Adora kind of reference it every once in a while. And like, you know, there's some underpinnings of like, yeah, it's been tough. I was, you know, I was at this facility, but like nothing more than that. So it's interesting to kind of see how they took liberties with this story and are sort of having him really delve and push in on this. So, you know, I think that's pretty interesting. And then he talks about Marion a little bit where he says
her sister. Yeah.
Yeah. How did she die? And Jackie goes, oh, well, she was always really, really sick. And he asks immediately, he's like, well, what about her autopsy?
Right.
And that's like a very interesting point where you're like, well, what do you mean, what about her autopsy? Like, no one would ever ask that, I guess, unless you were like a detective and you're trying to figure stuff out. But,
well, I think if he's starting to wonder if there is sort of like this longer pattern that has occurred here, like this greater history of violence that has occurred here in this town, could it be like, you know, if it is connected to the Preaker farm, if it's connected to the Krellen family, could something have started as far ago, you know, as far back in time ago as Marion? Like, could it be that she didn't die naturally? Is it possible that she was like stealthily murdered? And the autopsy line makes you wonder about that. I think the fact that you see like this vision of Marion at the end of the episode saying you're not safe here, I think certainly helps to emphasize that a little bit as well. So it's something that I hadn't really been considering as a possibility until this episode.
Right.
Like, no real reason to think that anything happened to Camille's sister beyond what we were told. But maybe there's more to that story.
Well, we hear the line, dead girls everywhere.
Dead girls everywhere.
So moving back, sort of Camille's kind of like finishing up her hang with the cheerleaders.
She's
for
getting
one,
dropped back off at the gas station store, which is always her spot.
I know, it's so weird. But like, you know, her friend, her one friend who's like, oh my God, it's always like this and it's kind of crazy. She confesses to knowing her secret about cutting herself, right?
Yes.
And then you see Cherry cut into her leg.
Right. And she knew that, like she, you know, she was like massaging her leg during cheerleading. And so she saw that. So, and I think there's a moment where Camille's like, why were you always so nice to me? We were terrible to you.
Yeah.
Because she's like, it seems like the only black person in their friend group. So they've just like been horrible to her.
Yeah.
And she's like, you were kind. Like you had your sister like die. Like you weren't there for a lot of it. There was no issue with you.
Yeah.
So it's a nice moment of just like the two of them kind of bonding and getting a sense that like maybe, you know, Camille has more friends here than she realizes.
Yeah, definitely.
We cut very quickly back to Adora.
Who's like, I can't believe she still hasn't moved her car.
Alan! He's like, oh, but you're better at handling the girls.
Oh my god, I love your Alan impression.
Stupid Alan.
No.
Anyway, so that's really just like a quick cut back to all of that.
And then, who skates up to this gas station? None other than a Miss Emma.
Yeah, so Emma, like, she and her friend, they like roll up on their roller skates right up to the gas station where Camille is buying her stuff. And like, at this point, like, Camille, I'm shocked, isn't just like, enough. This happens every single time I go to the gas station. Maybe she should be going to another place to shop unless she secretly likes being terrorized by Emma. But that moment when Emma and her friend like skate up to the window and they just like start pounding on the window.
Terrifying.
I see that you have this in your notes. You have a quote from me from last night watching the episode where I did say, I am prepared to declare that Emma is the worst, an actual nightmare person. like when she's like this, Emma is a nightmare person, like an absolute nightmare. And like, if that was somebody who was in my life in an active, present, everyday way, I would be over it very, 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 very swiftly. She like comes to the door to the glass window with like the energy of like the kids that are on PCP in that scene in Super Troopers 2, where they're like, yeah, more drugs, more tasers. Yeah. If you haven't seen Super Troopers 2 yet,
you definitely should.
Very fun movie.
Very silly.
Anyway, so Emma has showed up, and they want Camille to come along with them. Camille usually walks home. Camille's going to accept a ride from these people. That seems automatically like a bad decision.
Poor choice. And it's all, you know, all the high schoolers. So she's clearly out of her league already in terms of being like way older than everybody else is.
Yeah, what if someone's like, you look like you might be my mom's age, and it's like at first that's an insult, but it's like my mom's like 33. Like, oh, that's
exactly
good.
And then we're like, oh, that's our age.
I'm all right with 33. I'll take 33.
Yeah. But then you can tell that like there are things brewing, right? So Emma's in the front seat, she turns around and she reveals that she's got Oxy with her,
right?
And she's like, oh, it's the best, like it just relaxes me, blah blah. And she opens it out with her hand. And you don't really see what Camille does.
You don't see it yet, but it gets revealed later that Camille takes the Oxy, yes.
Right, which is
a questionable choice.
A great thing to mix with all the other, you know, alcohol and stuff you have.
Cool story,
system.
30-some-odd older sister taking Oxy with your teenage half-sister. Right. This seems like a great decision to make.
And then it becomes very obvious very quickly that, indeed, Camille will be attending this teenage party, and Emma's like, yeah, we're just stopping here for like 5 minutes, and you're like, oh no,
house party.
Yeah, so they show up to the house party. It feels like everybody from high school is there. John Keane and Ashley walk in, and then everyone decides to drop some ecstasy.
There's something with Ashley that we haven't even talked about that we had forgotten to mention. In that scene where Camille is interviewing Ashley, like she's going to notice that like Ashley has like a chunk of her ear that's missing.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot about that. Sorry.
And doesn't she calls her out on it here when they meet up again, or somebody says something where it gets noted.
Yeah, where they're like, you got that bitten out of your ear, right?
Yeah, it makes you wonder, was that Natalie?
That's my assumption. I was going to assume it was Natalie, you know, or it was Anne or somebody.
If it was somebody who was like physically violent, I think, you know, that holds, which would be a very compelling layer to add to Natalie once again. Anyway, neither here nor there, or maybe very here or there. So worth bringing up.
Anyway, Emma and her two friends kind of take control of the DJ at the party, or they just change the song, basically. And, you know, suddenly, like, Camille's starting to feel the effects of everything she's taken, right? And she's watching everybody.
It's the Oxy, and then it's she takes the ecstasy. She's like, Emma like kisses the ecstasy into her mouth, which is...
Right, and you're like, no.
What's going on here? Like, oh my goodness.
Moments like these, I'm happy I'm an only child.
oh, man.
Like, not going to kiss your sibling.
I don't know. Who knows? Listen, I've been watching a lot of Game of Thrones recently, so it is what it is. But that's... So now, like, Camille is on both Oxy and ecstasy. and she's going to have she's suddenly going to have like a new appreciation or at least interest in Emma, where the two of them are just like going to start like rolling all over Wind Gap, both rolling on ecstasy and rolling on roller skates.
Rolling with the homies.
Yes, indeed. There's almost like a suck and blow quality.
I know, I'm telling you. This was like Clueless, just 2018 style.
Yeah.
Way more drugs and alcohol.
Yes. As long as they don't get on the freeway, we'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But they're roller skating all over the place, and Vickery kind of catches them out of the corner of his eye, right? They roller skate past him at one point.
Doesn't do anything about it. He's just kind of watching them.
Yeah.
And then he goes into the restaurant where Detective Messina is.
Is having breakfast for dinner.
Breakfast for dinner. Yeah. Brinner.
No meat sauce for him tonight.
As it's been called. No meat sauce. No spaghetti marinara. That hasn't happened for him yet.
Anyway, so following kind of up on Vickery's like original hunch, right? He's like, well, a Mexican worker ID'd Keen as the one who dumped the bike in the pond, and like this is what's going on. So like he's already like kind of like playing in like these weird like racial undertones, which is something he was trying to say earlier, like, oh, it could be like a Mexican guy who did this, or like a trucker, or like whatever. Right.
But if he's IDing John Keen as the guy who dumped
the bike. No, I know, but it's still just like it fits in that like perfect, like sort of like tight wrapping of like him being like, well, this person, you know, said this and blah blah blah. Like, I don't know.
Totally. But it makes me wonder, like, when the next episode starts up, how quickly is John Keen going to be in handcuffs? Like, right. It feels like, from Vickery's standpoint, he's going to be ready to book that guy.
Yes.
Anyway, who knows? They continue roller skating. They do, like, a ring around the rosy on
I've
the roller
just
skates.
I had, like, a great vision of, like, what if Chris Messina and Vickery were roller skating together?
That's an incredible mental image. Of them just like going around back and forth with like Vickery's like mustache. Who knows what kinds of crumbs he's collected in there. Great moment.
They call that kind of a mustache a cookie duster.
Yes, in an alternate timeline. That's a great, great scene. But we have that ring around the rosy with Emma and Camille.
Yeah, and they so that's a really powerful moment when they're going around and around and around. And as Camille sort of like whips around faster and faster, Emma is morphing in front of her eyes, and clearly this is a moment of, like, the drugs taking effect and her memory sort of, like...
Bleeding together.
And every single turn we see is a different dead girl.
Right, yes.
So it's Marion, it's Natalie, it's Anne.
Her roommate.
Also her roommate from rehab. So that's a pretty powerful moment, and I really, really love that moment. I think it's really well done. Thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, I think she's surrounded by death, you know, and like I feel like she can't escape it, and I think that this is a moment that's reminding her of that. She's probably concerned for her sister and like her sister being here, and to some extent feeling like a part of herself died here in Wind Gap, so she's probably feeling some kind of kinship with these people
totally.
As well. But I mean, it triggers that, like it triggers her seeing like these visions of the past, which will manifest in a darker way, even in a moment or two here, when you know, Emma's like, "All right, I want to sleep with you tonight." Camille's like, "I don't know, I think I'm just gonna go to bed." And Emma's like, "Then gonna like roll off into the night." And so Camille's like, "No, that's fine, sleep with me, sleep in my room, it'll be great." And Emma just like comes like bulldozing at Camille. I thought it was a great moment that she just like tackle hugs her.
I know.
But the two of them, they sneak back into the house, and they're climbing up the stairs, not exactly stealthily.
And it reminds Camille of, like, sneaking into the house with Marion,
totally,
right?
Totally. It's like she's having, like, flashbacks to her own childhood.
Yeah.
And one of the moments that I really liked was as they're about to, like, climb the stairs, the way that the stairs are meant to be climbed, Camille then shows Emma, like, a shortcut in the staircase, which basically involves, like, climbing over the banister. I thought that was really cute of, like the hacks around your house.
Right, and then Josh laughs and goes like, "Did you ever used to do that in your house?" And I'm like, "No."
I could think of like the staircase in like one of my, like, we moved around a little tiny bit when I was a kid, and we had like this one house, and there was this staircase where like I remember always just like doing like this little hop around like the L shape of the stair to like cut a corner just a little bit quicker, and you could like swing your way up to like skip a few steps. It's just like a fun, stupid thing to do when you're a kid and you're freaking bored and you just want to get to places faster or differently or feel like you know your space a little bit better than anybody else around you knows it. And I feel like there's an idea of that that's involved here in this moment where Camille climbs the balcony, where it's like, come on, sis, let me show you a thing or two. Like, I know the house,
except
too.
It's like not graceful at all.
It's not graceful at all. It's very funny. But I do think that there's just like this little subtle idea there of like, I've been in Wind Gap before. I know my way around the block here a little bit. You don't have to act so tough around me. Like, I can show you a thing or two. But they get into bed. They go to, like, you know.
No, wait, hold on.
That's right. There's the...
This is a very important moment.
You see the first little sight of Ghost Marion, like, peeking up at them from downstairs.
Yeah, the beauty of DVR allowed us to rewind for a second.
Yeah, because, like, it's very blink and you'll miss it, much like we just did in the recapping of it, where, like, they get up the stairs and, like, they go to their room and there's this very quick, like, maybe 2 seconds, 3 seconds at most. I think that's even being generous in terms of the time of you just, like, see what appears to be somebody downstairs at the foot of the stairs.
And I would assume
in.
It was like Adora at first, because you can sort of see the top of their head and it looks a little blonde. So you're like, oh, maybe Adora's catching them sneak in.
Right, especially because you're going to see Adora in a minute here, like peeking in and looking at Camille and Emma on the bed from the room. So like, is it just Adora like watching her, you know, her two surviving daughters being weird together? But instead, no, it's weirder. It seems to be Marion, Ghost Marion, staring up at them. So it's like this specter of this murder or death or whatever it is that occurred long ago, peeking back in on the present right now.
Right. And it's also not something that Camille notices, nor Emma, right? It's not in the purview of like the character where you're like, oh, it could be her hallucinating. Like, it's just a figure.
Right.
And so that is pretty chilling.
It's very chilling. It's very chilling. And I think it's the kind of imagery that's really pushing us and ramping us up towards the next level of the story as we have 2 episodes left after this one.
Yeah. So we see Camille and Emma get into her room and Adora does peek in to kind of see them snuggling up together. And then Camille kind of like looks up and there's Marion.
Right.
And what does she say?
It's not safe for you here. What is going on?
Yeah.
And then the episode ends. So,
and that's it.
Yeah, a very ominous note to send us into the final 2 episodes of
Sharp
Objects.
I can't believe it's only 2 episodes more.
Yeah, well, I'm excited that it's only 2 episodes more. I love the self-contained story. I'm assuming we're going to get, you know, all of like the narratively satisfying answers by the end of this. Can't imagine that they're planning on doing like a multiple season thing. I think it's probably just the done in one.
Right.
And so that's really exciting that we're so close to the end of the line here. You know, I'm very eager to see how it's all going to shake out. So 2 episodes left of Sharp Objects. We're going to have our podcast for episode 7 Falling, probably coming to you midweek next week, Wednesday or Thursday. Keep an eye out for that podcast. Emily, anything else from this episode that you feel like we need to revisit, rehash, anything before we close out?
No, I would just say like takeaways are we're really kind of honing in on everything. You know, was there anything that surprised you out of everything?
No, it's ramping up. It's ramping up. And for me, it's feeling like it's coming into sharper focus I think Alan and Jackie are two of my top candidates on the board right now.
Okay.
I still think like, I feel like it's very easy if it's Adora. I'm not gonna love it if it's Camille unless they have a really good explanation for why it would be Camille. But you also feel like Emma probably knows a thing or two here. So I don't know. I'm going to be very interested to see how this is all playing out. But Jackie and Alan are my top two suspects on the board. And maybe that'll be, you know, this might be my last time to offer up who I think is, you know, a culprit here. Because with 2 episodes left, who knows? By the end of next week, by the end of the penultimate, I wouldn't be surprised. I think that's kind of like a classic move for a show like this. It's like, now you introduce the killer.
Yeah.
Like, now you introduce who it is, and the final episode will resolve everything. So hard to know exactly how this is going to play out in terms of all of that. But this could be the end of some, you know, semblance of speculation on this podcast. So very excited to see where we're going.
It's been fun taking your temperature, you know, on what you think is happening. I've really enjoyed this. It's a rare moment in time where I know more about a story than you do. So it's been a It's been a fun collaboration.
No, I'm loving it. I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Well, it's not over yet. We got two more podcasts to go. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss these podcasts. Postshowrecaps.com/iTunes is the way to do that. Your ratings and reviews are greatly appreciated. We've got a ton of stuff happening on Post Show Recaps right now. The Game of Thrones rewatch, it is full steam ahead. We are taking 1 week off next week and then back into it. We're in the thick of season 5, so getting very close to the end of the line. And by very close to the end of the line, I mean still probably like 20 some odd weeks, but you know, it's getting up there. It's moving along. Antonio Mazzaro and I, we are podcasting about The Sinner season 2, USA Network's The Sinner, having a really good time. You can listen to that podcast at postshowrecaps.com/iTunes. Antonio and Rob Sesternino are talking Better Call Saul. Rob and Jessica Lease are talking Fear of the Walking Dead. So much is happening here, Emily.
I know.
It's a very prolific summer here on Post Show Recaps.
Tune in, guys.
Tune in, indeed. And we will be back next week with our penultimate Sharp Objects podcast.
Indeed.
Indeed. All right. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye.